So these introductions are usually scripted. I sit down and I type something out. But today I'm actually sitting in my car, having just dropped off my son for his first day of his senior year of high school. And if you don't have kids this age or older, it's hard to explain how freaking fast it all goes by. But it is insane how fast it all goes by. My son is almost 17. He's about my height. We have the same size 13 shoes. He now beats me fairly regularly in one-on-one basketball. And I just can't help but think of him as a little kid with a squeaky voice, looking up to me, wanting to spend time with me. You know, all the cliches are true. You blink and they're men and women. And then you blink again and they're gone. So if you're a young parent, or even if you're just starting out in this career, and you feel like the days are going to last forever and youth is going to last forever, it doesn't. So you just need to embrace it and enjoy it and seize it and try to keep track of the moments as best you can. Because before too long, you're going to be sitting in the front seat of a car outside of a Brugger's Bagels, wondering where all the time went. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers Thing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Jordan Holman, the terrific New York Times business writer. This is episode number 325. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks.
And nobody cares about your stupid TV show.
All right, Jordan, I have to say, usually when I do this podcast and I'm sitting somewhere and I look at my guest, they usually seem kind of sluggish and they're kind of like, I'm a journalist and it's so hard and blah, blah, blah. You ooze optimism. You're 29 years old. You're writing for the New York Times. You're rolling along in life. Are you actually optimistic about journalism, or are you just a happy person on this Thursday morning in July?
Yes and yes. I'm optimistic about journalism and I'm having a good day so far.
Being serious, let's just start there 100%. Yeah. I tend to work in sports most of my career. ESPN just had a shitload of layoffs. The Athletic laid off people. Everyone seems to be laying off people. I know a lot of young journalists looking for work. Why are you optimistic about it?
I'm going to be honest. I picked business journalism to shield myself from some of that pain that the industry is seeing. I honestly went into business journalism because I saw some buyouts when I was at an internship in Chicago, and I saw the business journalists were safe. And that's the path I'd been on. So just when I think about my experience, I luckily have not been in a situation where I faced layoff or I've had a huge mass of my colleagues face layoff. So that is definitely a privilege in this industry, but I'm definitely aware of the broader sector, but I still feel optimistic.
Wait, I love something you said here, because I was thinking about this when I was reading your clips. First of all, you're a lovely writer. You're an excellent reporter. So this is what I'm about to say is not a dog on you at all. But I'm going through your clips and I'm thinking, like, for example, I have a story in front of me. You wrote Macy's CEO, Jeff Gennette, to depart, right? Macy's is shuffling its leadership team, announcing on Wednesday that Jeff Gennette, the chief executive since 2017, will retire in February after four decades with the department store chain. He'll be succeeded by Tony Spring, who runs the company's luxury Bloomingdale's chain. I don't give a shit, right? Like, I don't actually care about like Macy's and what happens at Macy's. And reading the topics you cover, I was thinking, these are not topics that would particularly interest me as a journalist to write about. You actually just said that you sort of entered this world in part because of the security that accompanies it. Did you also have to learn to care about the subject, or did you come in with some of that?
Ooh, I think I did have to learn to care about the nuts and bolts that come with business reporting. So the story that you just pulled out, like, that's probably a type of story that I've written 100 times, could maybe write with my eyes closed and whatnot, because there's a formula. But I think the exciting thing about business journalism is that you need those nuts and bolts to then tell more interesting stories and differentiate and like enter a story that maybe everyone's interested in, but you're entering it from a different angle. And like those stories on Macy's, you know, CEO change or their earnings, it just gives me better insight to hopefully an interesting story that you would want to read. But I need to have that business acumen.
Wait, so do you feel like, okay, you do a story about the Macy's CEO and it's like, eh, it's fine. It's interesting enough to write, but it's not going to, like, you know, set rockets off for you. Do you feel like doing those stories leads to ideas of more interesting stories and deeper insights into business? Is that actually how you generate a lot of your ideas?
Yeah, that's one way I generate a lot of my ideas. So one, so for Macy's is a great example. I've written a lot about Macy's. One of the reasons I felt like it was necessary to write about the CEO leaving was he represents a lot with what's happening in how CEOs are presenting themselves. So he's a publicly gay CEO. He talks about that. That's rare. He did a lot of diversity efforts at the company in terms of like what Macy's is selling to Black consumers, all of that. And I just felt like he is an interesting person, but I would not have known those things if I wasn't covering Macy's day to day, calling them, saying I'm interested in XYZ. And so that is a way I generate stories and get into more interesting stories.
Like when you're a sports writer, as an example, and you cover a team or you're writing about a team, let's say you're doing something about the New York Mets, and you're covering a Mets game and you learn that the catcher speaks five languages. Well, then you're naturally going to go to the catcher and do a profile of him speaking five languages. In the business world, is there any suspicion or is there a reluctance when you try to delve into more than fired, hired, earnings, et cetera? Like, are there people who are like, wait, why are you going there with this?
So like, yes, because I feel like I could answer this. Yes. The comms people are obviously going to be like, wait, tell me the whole story so I can like protect my company. I can protect my exec. But I think on the side, if I'm just talking to a worker, they're not coming with that suspicion. They're just like, wait, you care about things beyond just my skill function here or the topic that I thought, like maybe I'm focused on supply chain, but now you're interested in how me speaking five languages could impact the way I'm doing my job, or I don't know. Like, I feel like, no, there's not necessarily that suspicion because at the end of the day, we all have a job. We're all workers. We're all contributing to some type of company or enterprise. And why not tell their full stories?
In a way, the Mets catcher, when you go up to him, he's going to be like, ugh, another person asking me about five languages, right? So in a way, do you feel like if you were writing about the blah, blah, blah at Macy's or the so-and-so person at Harmon, are they actually excited to talk to you?
Like at the executive level, probably they're rolling their eyes. If it's a topic that I feel like they've talked about a lot, if I read, you know, in the journal or in Bloomberg or whoever has already written it, I'm sure they've been prepped. They know what the questions are going to be. So, and then it's like, oh, I'm talking to a reporter. Like, what do I get out of it? But if it's at another level of someone who doesn't interact with a reporter every day, like at a different mid-level or entry level, I don't think there's that eye rolling. There's just the genuine, I think they're more curious about what I do in my job or how I function. And I'm getting a lot of questions from them. And then I like turn the conversation back to them, obviously.
Well, you did a piece March 20th, 2023, the chaotic, dispiriting work of liquidating Harmon stores. The subhead was employees of the beauty and health chain said Bed Bath & Beyond's decision to shut it down had caught them by surprise. Communication never got better. And your lead was, it had been a busy but successful holiday season at the Harmon Face Value store in Morris Plains, New Jersey. And I just want to say, I used to live near Harmon and I freaking loved Harmon. The location performed well enough to win a contest among the entire health and beauty chain stores involving sales of appliances like blow dryers and electronic toothbrushes. Jenny Bernard, the manager, was looking forward to a visit from the district manager and Harmon's head of merchandising to discuss upgrades to the store. She hoped that additional lights would be added, helping to illuminate the shelves and enticing shoppers to spend more. Instead, on January 26, after a brief conference call in which executives from Bed Bath & Beyond, Harmon's parent company since 2002, shared their decision to liquidate all 49 of the chain stores, Ms. Bernard found herself texting her employees to tell them they would soon lose their jobs. She didn't know exactly when, and there were questions about issues like health insurance and severance pay, but it was coming. We all cried, said Ms. Bernard, 44, who had been with Harmon for 8 years. It was just absolute disbelief that this was happening. All right. And it's a really, really lovely, well done story about sort of the demise of Harmon because of the demise of Bed Bath & Beyond. Soup to nuts. Do you come up with this idea? Is it assigned to you? And then how do you go about it?
So I have been covering Bed Bath & Beyond's demise, mostly on the Bed Bath & Beyond, like the financial side of it all. And so that's the story that you just referenced on Harmon. I actually got a tip from a worker who emailed me saying, everyone's talking about Bed Bath & Beyond. Like Harmon over here, we feel like the sacrificial lamb. They just kind of cast us off. I feel like more needs to be talked about. And so that's when I got interested in that story, because I feel like she definitely called it for what it was. I remember seeing the Harmon headline and we just kind of moved on because we're like, it's a small piece. So from there, pitched it to my editor saying probably something to the effect of, are we interested in Harmon as a sacrificial lamb story? And he was like, yes. And so from there, just like reaching out to other workers at Harmon.
Hey, I'm not letting you off the hook with this. Your editor says yes. And then you have to sort of micro, like you have to get really micro. It's not just this corporate story laid off, blah, blah, blah. You actually go to the, so like, I don't know, do you show up at a store? Like, how does that happen?
So the stores were in the process of closing, but the ones nearest to me had already closed, I believe. So I was using LinkedIn, which is my favorite social media site. And so reaching out to workers on LinkedIn. I'm also doing past and present because Harmon stores have been closing. So reaching out to folks maybe who had left a few months ago, getting all types of responses. Some people really wanted to share their story. Some people thought I was being a leech, saying like, why are you reaching out to me now when, you know, I'm losing my job? Like, this seems unfair that you're trying to, you know, just capitalize on my pain almost. And so definitely respected them and saying, you don't have to talk to me. But from there, just like kind of using a network of workers, you know, I talked to one, said, hey, do you have any other colleagues that you think would want to talk to me? And that's how I did that sourcing.
Wait, there's a couple of things I want to ask here. Number one, I never use LinkedIn. I mean, I know of LinkedIn, I have LinkedIn, and maybe in my world, it's not. Why is LinkedIn so, why are you so big on LinkedIn?
So I cover companies, and most people, if they're trying to get a job in the industry I'm writing about, or not just retail, but just at companies, they use LinkedIn pretty consistently. And so I just find that that is a helpful thing. Not saying that I don't also use Twitter, but when I started coming up as a business journalist, everyone's like, LinkedIn is the place where your sources are at.
And do you message people directly over LinkedIn? And do you find that most people check their messaging on LinkedIn?
Yes. So I have LinkedIn Premium, so I can message as many people as I want. And I'll message them. But if I can find that their email is attached to their LinkedIn profile, I'll do both. I'll message them on LinkedIn. I'll also shoot them an email.
Wait, I'm being super nerdy, but this is a super nerdy podcast. What percentage of the time do you reach out to someone via LinkedIn, either DMing on LinkedIn or then getting their email from LinkedIn and it succeeds?
Let's see. That's a good question. Maybe 70% of the time.
Yeah, that's high. That's good.
Yeah, because you can also see if someone read your message, and I'm not afraid to be like, yeah, it's, so here's a link to some other stuff, you know, just to try to prompt them and show it's not a bot. That's the other thing I'm finding, like LinkedIn's really nice because if you try to message people on Facebook these days, I feel like a lot of people think it might be spam or some kind of bot, but LinkedIn is still thought of as, I get a message just from a real person.
Wait, let's get super, super granular nerdy. So I actually find reaching out to people is a trick because, like you just said, a lot of times you reach out to people on Facebook and they either never actually see the message or they think you're spam. A lot of times if you reach out to people on Twitter, especially nowadays, the Twitter has turned into like liquid diarrhea. They never get the DM, or it's just one. It's right alongside a quote, hot 19-year-old from China who quote, just wants to be friend. So it does seem really hard to get people to believe that the social media message they are getting is an actual person actually seeking something. So when you write a message to someone and you have to hit them quick and you want them to respond, how do you do it?
Hi, my name is Jordan Holman. I write about the retail sector at the Times, or if it's something very specific, I say like whatever is their expertise, like I'm writing about XYZ thing. Trying to wrap my head around this subject. I see that you might be an expert, would love to chat, phone number.
And it works, mostly, sometimes.
So my caveat also is like the 70% also includes the people who get back to me in 6 months, like, hey, are you still working on it? But then I still am like, I'm glad I got you. And I'll like come up with the reason to keep them talking.
I've literally reached out to people for books I've been writing. And 3 years later, I will get a response. Hey, am I too late for this? Might be too late for this one.
But here is my book link. Please buy it.
Exactly. But I think you'll enjoy the book. Number two, I wanted to ask is, so you reach out to these people who lost their jobs. They have lost their jobs and their livelihood. And this was a way of making a living. And for all you know, they worked at Harmon for 15 years and they loved Harmon and their heart has been ripped out. And a lot of these people not only don't want to hear from you, but are probably sort of do feel like people view us in the media sometimes that we're feasting on the carcass of a dead roadside animal. Is there a way you tiptoe up to people, or is there a way you feel like you get people to talk when they are reluctant / angry / hurt?
Yes. I will offer to say, hey, this first conversation we have is off the record. I don't usually actually use the word off the record right away. If it's not like an executive, just because I don't think a worker or like someone who doesn't have a PR person attached to them necessarily knows that. So usually I'll say like, I truly do want to hear your story. You can share as much or as little of it as you want. I'm not recording this. I just want you to understand like where I'm coming from, and I want to better understand where you're coming from. And so sometimes from that, going back to the like, I'm a real person ethos, from that conversation at the end of it, be like, you know, actually, I feel comfortable. Like, we can have another conversation, or if you want to use XYZ thing, like, definitely use it. Like, that's one way I tiptoe into that.
You had a piece May 25th, 2023. You co-bylined it with Julie Cresswell, but we know you're the genius behind the story. The headline is Brands Embracing Pride Month Confront a Volatile Political Climate. A subhead, Target became the latest company to adjust plans for marketing supportive of the LGBTQ community after it faced backlash from some customers. Lead was, for years, Pride Month, the annual celebration for LGBTQ Americans, has afforded companies a marketing opportunity to tap into the buying power of a group with growing financial, political, and social clout. Yet while these efforts have always faced some opposition, brands and marketers say the country's current political environment, especially around transgender issues, has made this year's campaigns more complicated. It's about Target sort of taking a lot of their stuff and moving it to the different section of the store. And I wonder, like, as someone who covers business, can you ever think, wow, look at that. There's a company and they're just doing good because they want to do the right thing. Or do you always have to be suspicious that truly it's ultimately about marketing and selling and making money, and the charity is a way of looking good?
I think it's the latter. Like, I definitely, there's a business strategy to everything. It's like the lens of how I see things. And it kind of is funny because I cover consumer companies. I cover places where I shop at, you know, that I'm buying stuff, that my friends are buying stuff. But I know ultimately, like, large corporations don't make decisions out of like the goodness in their heart. That could be part of it, but also part of their calculation is thinking about the money, is thinking about their investors, is thinking about how this might land to reporters like me.
So when you're covering something like this, this issue, which is an enormously, for me personally, exasperating issue in modern times, like, it's so stupid. But when you're covering it and you have to talk to the fill in the blank CEO, and the fill in the blank CEO says, the thing, Jordan, is we here at blank really are committed to the diversity of blah, 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 blah. And you know they're going to say that. Is there any way of cracking through that? Like, I know the corporate shell is a tough one. Is there any way of actually cracking through that and getting someone at so-and-so company to say, look, off the record, or look, we know it's bullshit, but what are we supposed to do here?
Yeah. The off the record is where the conversation happens, right? In terms of the like, let's level set. I'm not going to use this quote as you said it in this way, like the first one, the like boilerplate quote. But to step back to answer the question, I know, yeah, going into those conversations, I know that there's going to be a soundbite, or they're just going to say things this way. The way that I approach those conversations is to bring my own data, or even reference things that they have said before. XYZ company, you said that you cared about, you're trying to get to this level of brands owned by Black people. Are you there yet? Like, how does that strategy that you told me a year ago fit into this new decision you made? And just like try to use their own goals and measures. Because I feel like if you talk their language and if they know you did your research, that maybe they can't just give you the boilerplate, like someone coming in fresh. Just like, no, I've actually followed this. I've read the transcripts. I looked at the earnings calls. I know what I'm talking about. And I've also like followed what you've been talking about. So I think that's one way of doing it.
Wait, when you do a story like that and you work for the New York Times and, you know, we live in this era of the damnation of media and the quote unquote, the liberal media and fake news and all that nonsense. And you write for the New York Times, you're doing a piece about this and you call whoever, Moms for Liberty or some hard right group about their take. Are they willing to talk to a reporter from the New York Times?
Well, if they call me back, I think they're, I am braced for the, well, what's your agenda, Jordan? And I always just have to go back to, it's almost like explaining journalism, like just reminding people, I'm trying to get your perspective. This whole thing is blowing up. It's either referencing your group or groups like you. I'm trying to understand your perspective because without it, you're not getting your chance to say, like have your say. So yeah, I guess it does definitely come with baggage, but also I'm coming from the background of a business journalist. And for some reason, my perspective is like, it doesn't actually come with the business element doesn't come with some of the baggage of the cultural firestorm, if that makes sense. But I've definitely had people say like, well, you're not going to get it right or whatnot. And I'm always like, let's try it. Let's test it.
I would be like, I'm just a young journalist trying to eat. Won't you help me? You know, whatever.
Yeah. My boss is going to yell at me if you don't. Like, I don't.
Oh my God. I have used that. Look, my editor is just going to kill me. Will you help me out here?
We all have bosses. Like we all are just trying to do our jobs. Like that is a line I say often. And I think that also disarms people, that just gets you back in the place of like, okay, all right.
I'm going to throw a totally out of left field question for you. It has nothing to do with anything. Are you familiar with the random act of kindness ad campaign from Honda? Hey, we're paying for your rent because it's some guy in a Honda shirt shows up and they pay for the rent. All right, yes. Wait. This is a good corporate question. So my wife and I always have this debate. She'll watch the commercial and it'll be some Honda exec and it'll show up. There's one recently, literally, where a woman couldn't afford her rent and Honda is like, hey, we're paying your rent for the next month. And she starts crying. My wife's like, oh, that's really nice. And I'm like, Honda made a commercial out of this woman's suffering, a national commercial, and they're paying 1 month of her rent. Are you fucking kidding me? Am I too big of a cynic or am I on the right path here?
This actually reminds me of my love-hate relationship with the show Undercover Boss. So I think I lean more on your side, but I have been one to cry at that show.
Oh, man. Duality. It is so manipulative. It is so manipulative. I found an article in 2015. This is when you were at USC, and there's an article in the LA Times. Jordan Holman, a junior journalism major, said she was ambivalent about the Row, which is a part by USC when you went to school, as a possible destination because of her experiences there. She tried to go to a fraternity party in the fall of 2013 with two friends who were also Black. Before the trio could get into the party, a security guard asked to see their school and state identification. Meanwhile, two white women entered the house without being stopped. When Holman and her friends couldn't produce their state identifications, the security guard asked them to leave, she said. I felt extremely hurt, like I'd done something wrong, Holman said. I wanted to cry. How do experiences like that impact who you are, if at all, as a journalist?
It's like you brought up a heavy thing and then a lighter thing and whatnot.
We can go back to random act of kindness later.
No, this is a good question. It might sound cliche, but I did get into journalism to tell stories about people who look like me just because, and it wasn't necessarily from a dearth, because I grew up in a household that had like Ebony magazine and Jet magazine. So like that representation was there. So I saw the world and like, oh yeah, women right, Black people right, all that kind of stuff. And I think moments like the one I had at USC that time, discrimination, it knocks you back a bit because you're just like, why is someone treating me this way? And it almost sounds naive, but when you see the optimist in me, when you see the world where he's going about doing your thing, going to be a journalist, I'm going to do the right thing. And then you like are faced with the bad actor. It knocks you off a little bit, but then it also makes me want to do more good in journalism. And also realizing that someone who doesn't know me might just see me as a Black person. And I guess in my role as a journalist, I always want to make sure I'm seeing people for their full self and asking how they see the world and all of those things. So I guess that's how I look at it. It's like, yeah, you're going to have these horrible moments. You're going to have these moments that you're going to question, like, why the heck did someone do that to me? But then as a journalist, you have so much power to like help shape the narrative, help other people tell their stories. So at least if they do have those experiences in life, it's not with you. Like they can either, you know, you can just be a good light for them.
You obviously, you've written a lot about diversity in your career. When I was coming up, I still feel like there was a shitload of racism in journalism and a preconceived notion. Like my hero coming out of University of Delaware was a guy who was about 5 years older than me, who also went to Delaware, named Mike Freeman, who wrote for the New York Times. And all I wanted to do was be Mike Freeman, and Mike Freeman, Black. And I remember someone saying to me, well, you know, he's had it much easier than you because, you know, he's getting all these minority internships and blah, blah, blah. And I remember thinking at the time, are you fucking kidding me? Like, he's had it easier than me. Like, I'm a white guy in America. It's like I won the lottery. Do you feel like you still feel that? Do you feel like Black journalists, journalists of color still feel that, where people are like, oh, she's blank, or oh, she probably only got here because of blank, or oh, blah, 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 blank. Does that still come with this turf in 2023?
I would say so. I think lack of representation, small numbers of Black people, Hispanic, whatever, people try to fill that vacuum with explanations of, okay, then why is she here?
Right.
And which is very illogical, and you flip it on your head, you're like, well, maybe it's the system, not, I don't know, not me. But luckily, when I think about like my circle of mentors, of sponsors, of just good friends, they've never, like, they're all just people of color doing amazing things. So it's almost like this beautiful utopia within everything else that just is a reminder that I never should have to feel like I need to explain myself or my successes or whatnot. But yeah, it's definitely something you hear. I would say that people don't say it directly. I'll hear it maybe through the grapevine, and you're like, well, I'm not going to deal with that then.
It's actually crazy because this is the most diverse journalism field I've seen in my life, as far as how it is now. And like, it's just better. I feel like a long time ago, someone of your background, meaning a Black woman coming up through the ranks, might be discouraged from even entering journalism because you'd be like, nobody looks like me. I'm never going to get anywhere. Nobody's going to listen to me. And I just think it's very encouraging that at least people are finally entering the field and finding places to work.
Definitely. And the fact that I have a generation, two generations above me who have of Black women who have paved the path and who fought those fights and were definitely the onlys in the room, like that's a different type of strength. And I like lean on them.
So something happened recently that you posted that I just kind of loved, which is on your Instagram feed, you wrote a, this is 22 weeks ago. You're right. I absolutely love history and tradition. That's why it was so heartwarming to receive this memento of my first front page article, which the Times gives to reporters for their first page one story or photo. What a fun way to mark 6 months here. And it's basically a plate, the metal plated of your first front page story. Your first front page story, I believe if I have this right, Jordan, was retailers push sales and normalcy, but economic uncertainty looms. It ran on November 25th, 2022. What I loved about this is you have been raised in a digital world. You have been raised in a world where 98% of people get their information from a screen, not from a piece of paper. Yet being given a front page meant something to you. Why?
Like, it's A1, you know? okay. Seriously. I do love history, and part of going to the New York Times, you're like, well, it is a digital news org with a paper, and you know, they call it the report, but people still care about the front page. And I think for, you know, being able to show my parents, being able to show my cousins and share that tradition, they were psyched. Like, they're like, yeah, we're reading your story on the phone or whatever. But like, to actually have this physical manifestation of what you've been doing at work today, like, that's so dope.
Please tell me you have moments where you're like, holy shit, I work for the New York Times.
Yes. And to be honest, I need to have other people sometimes pinch me, because when you're just like doing things, you make calls and whatnot. But I have an older cousin who's like a sister to me, and she loves the Times app, and she'll be the one like, oh my gosh, wait, so will this be in the paper the next day? Okay, I got to get a paper. Where can I get a paper? You know, so it's the others around me that like help remind me, like, this isn't like a small local thing. This is the New York Times. Man.
You're living the journalism dream, Jordan. You are. Like, first of all, I just want to say, I love your resume, right? I love your resume. I love your LinkedIn page. Number one, because you apparently speak Chinese, which is kind of crazy. Are you fluent in Chinese, or are you just like,
oh, I need to take classes again, but I took it all through college and high school.
You got Chinese on you. You went to Bloomberg, 6 years at Bloomberg and New York Times. And you had a piece that I love that jumped off the page to me when you were at Bloomberg. And it was, Amazon Union is a tough sell in a town where $15 an hour goes a long way. And here's what I loved about it. My last book was about a football player / baseball player named Bo Jackson. And Bo Jackson is from Bessemer, Alabama. And I spent a lot of time, see your eyes just widen. I spent a lot of time in Bessemer, Alabama. And there is nothing to do in Bessemer, Alabama. And for this story, correct me if I'm wrong, you spent a decent amount of time at Bessemer, Alabama's one and only Waffle House.
Waffle House.
All right. Why? Why were you at Waffle House in Bessemer, Alabama?
Yeah. So that story was about a union campaign at Amazon at this warehouse in Bessemer. And between shifts, workers go to the Waffle House. So I basically camped myself out at Waffle House between shifts. And so I'm doing like third shift. So like 2 a.m., 3 a.m. to just talk to workers who are coming off their shift and just ordering, like, you know, their waffles and saying and chatting them up.
Give me the scene of like, you're at this Waffle House, you're kind of camped out at this Waffle House. How do you even approach people to get them to talk?
Yeah. So I did a recon mission earlier in the day, aka I ate at Waffle House and met some of the workers there, like, hey, the Jordan, waitresses.
Yeah. Can we agree? You and I, Waffle House kicks ass.
Yes.
Kicks ass.
It does. I wish I still lived in the South.
Jordan, would you like to join me in investing in a Waffle House? I'm making this opportunity right now.
I think we should do it.
Yes.
Yeah. This feels like Shark Tank.
Totally. This is great. All right, go ahead. We're at Waffle House.
Yeah. So I like chatted up the waitresses, because my idea was the Waffle House is small. Anyone who's been in a Waffle House knows it's small. And I should kind of let the waitresses know who I am, make it make sense why I'm going to spend 3 hours or so just sitting there. And so chat. And then also, I was like, I want to get to know these waitresses because they live in Bessemer, and I was trying to get a vibe of what the city was like. So, yeah, had gone probably like at 9 p.m., went back to my hotel, went to sleep, set an alarm for one, and then just went out to the Waffle House again and like camped myself out at the counter. And so then Amazon workers started flowing in, and I let them order. And then while they were waiting for their order, because they have to stay, I would just walk up and introduce myself.
Is it good to talk to people while they're eating?
No, I think that's the most annoying thing. I was chatting with them while they were waiting for their food.
So you wouldn't like, hey, can I blah, blah, blah in the middle of their hash browns?
I guess I could have, but the wrinkle in this, I was there February 2021. And so you actually, I was going to say you couldn't eat inside, but that actually Alabama did not have those COVID rules.
It's Alabama. Yeah. There were no.
Yeah, so I was like, wait, I'm making that up. I think it was that most people were getting it to go. They weren't actually sitting down. So I saw that earlier. And so that's why I was like, I need to either be camped out in the parking lot or just while they're waiting for the food.
Before we continue with Two Riders Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Casey Perlman, and I'm here with Anna Norris, my co-host on the hit KSDTU radio show.
We're so crazy.
So, with the Screen Actors on strike, I landed us this pretty sweet gig doing an ad for my dad's podcast.
What the fuck's a podcast?
This thing old people watch.
Well, what's the ad for?
RoyalRetros.com. It's a throwback sports merchandise company that makes pretty sweet t-shirts, hats, and jerseys of old sports leagues.
Do we get paid?
In t-shirts. But he also says if we do a good job, we might advance to hats and jerseys.
And then what?
And then you wear a hat.
Hard pass. I'm going back to my side hustle slinging rocks on the streets of La Jolla.
So I started my career at the National Tennessean. I'm from New York, started my career at the National Tennessean. And I think one of the things I struggled with, well, was the South in general, right? Because I think I came with a certain New York arrogance to the South. And, oh, aren't these people cute? Like that kind of douchey way of being. When I was in early 20s, I was kind of a dick. You're from Chicago. You go to the South. Do you change the way you approach someone based on geography? Do you add a little twang to your talk? Do you do it? You know what I mean? Like, is there a way?
Yeah.
Do you feel like that stuff matters at all?
So one of my mom's friends, when I first moved to, I was living in Atlanta at this time I did the Alabama story. So when I first moved to Atlanta, one of my mom's friends was like, let me give you some tips of how to conduct business. Oh. And the first, and I think maybe only one, was just refer to people as like Ms. and Mr. if you're first meeting them. Sure. And then also know that you should have a conversation like, how's the weather? How's your kids? Like, don't get straight into it like we do in New York. And I was like, okay, I can do that. But as I spent more time in the South, I realized like Chicago does have a lot of Southern sensibilities, like compared to New York. Mm-hmm. So I didn't feel like I needed to switch it up too much.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
The South confused me. I was like lost. I truly was a fish out of water. I was like, I'm a fast talker and I talk with my hands.
Right.
I curse a lot and I don't go to church. And like the whole, it was a rough. See,
so one thing that's not clear on my LinkedIn or this biography is my parents are from Springfield, Illinois, which is Southern or Central Illinois, but operates kind of Southern life. So I just tap back into that, especially if I'm like facing someone who's like, oh, you're from the North, you don't get it. And I'll like pull the card of like, no, my family, my ancestral roots are somewhat Southern. So I did grow up in church and I'll just pull on those experiences.
I always say this on the show, but I'm interested in your thoughts. I feel like a lot of what we do, even if it doesn't sound that great, is kind of salesmanship. Like, no, you just like you're trying to get this person to.
Yeah, because it's also like, why? Yeah. Convincing them to talk to you in general, but then also like, why are they talking to you versus another reporter? So yeah. I love that I've lived in all these different places around the U.S. because I can find some way of connecting with folks. That's just my big thing. I'm like, how can I connect with people? How can I keep them talking to me? And yeah, I don't see anything negative with that. I actually, that makes you a smart reporter, I feel like.
Well, you had a piece recently, last month, This Salon Works to Understand Black Women's Hair. I used to say, when I was covering baseball, one of my go-to guys was this ball player for the Dodgers named Sean Green. And Sean Green, like me, was a liberal Jewish guy. And I'd always see him and I'd go, hey, you go to any bar mitzvahs lately or anything like that, just kind of to lighten it. You do a story about black hair as a black woman who surely uses black hair products or at least has used black hair products, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Could I write the same story you wrote? Could I get the same insights you wrote? Or do you feel like commonalities in reporting, whatever they may be, give you something over the bald white guy doing the story?
I know how capable you are as a reporter, so I'm sure you could get the same story. But I would say I can speak in shorthand with a lot of those women where they don't have to spell out, and then I needed to wash this hair. Oh, it was so frustrating when I walked outside and my hair frizzed up. Like I remember listening back to the interview because I spent the day with them. And a lot of the times I was like, mm-hmm, yeah, no, I same here. Or like, oh, I keep my braids in for 6 weeks. You only do 4 weeks. And then it just opens them up. And, you know, some of those, I knew I used parentheticals in some of the story or part of the story to just say like, oh, she listens on YouTube, because those are kind of like one off. That wasn't a direct question I asked. I just pulled things that we were just chatting with on the side. So 100% me being a black woman who uses these products, who has thoughts on these products, I'm asking them questions that you probably wouldn't.
I love your writing and I love your career. I'm all in on this. Seriously. I always ask this, but you're a youngin, so you may not have that good of an answer. What's the worst conflict, sort of moment of awkwardness you've had in your journalism career, perhaps with a source or a subject or someone?
Ooh. Well, there was one story I did a few years ago. I was at Bloomberg at the time, and it was focused on like a Black super PAC. And so at the time, I wasn't covering retail. I was covering the equality team. And so I was writing about this fund that started around the 2018 election, I believe, like the midterms. And I was like really interested. It's like these Black millionaires had started this company or this fund to fund politicians that would, you know, fund their causes, da da da. And I was like really excited to do the story, but they weren't giving like any access. I was like, oh, I can meet you in DC. No, like, oh, I could, no. Oh, don't even call, you know, like that kind of stuff. And I was like, okay, what can I do? And they did let me listen to one of like the funding calls that they had just to talk about the issues that they cared about. And so opportunity zones came up as one of the issues. And they had like the president of the NAACP on and someone else. And there was this point where like they disagreed on the best way of accomplishing Black economic freedom. And I wrote that in the story, like basically saying Black people aren't a monolith when it comes to our political ideology, da da da. And I so did not think it was that controversial, but like the story went out, the fund did not take kindly to it. The PR person, and then I'm on to my next story. I remember I was in Florida and I get a phone call and the PR person was like, why is this painted in a bad light? Da da da. Why didn't you warn us? Da da da. And you know, I had gone through the fact check, but I think that just was a moment of one, like, oh wow, your published work lands with impact and people are going to perceive, you know, you had this idea of how it would land or whatnot. Some might have other ideas. But then also it was like conflict, because I think part of it was, you're a Black reporter. Why don't you get what we're trying to do? And like, why would you make us look bad in this light? And I think that was one of my first experiences of that. It's like, I'm a reporter. And yes, I have this sensibility where I can understand. And maybe other reporters wouldn't have caught like the nuance and the difference in agreement. But like, my job is to air that out. So that was a tough situation. I definitely remember calling my editor like, this doesn't need a correction, right? And just like learning how to talk through those instances. But I think about that sometimes.
First of all, the story you're referring to, February 1st, 2019, wealthy Black executives take on racial inequality. And what's really fascinating about that is I think we all have these experiences, whether you're Black, white, Asian, blah, 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 where someone's like, hey, I thought we were cool. And you're like, yeah, it's not really we. Like, I know you think it's we.
Yeah,
I've literally had that with white people in cars who are like, hey, like racist people are like, wait, I thought we were we. And I'm like, yeah, we're not we. Like, it's you.
Yeah.
That is an interesting thing that someone thinks, like, because we try to get them to confide in us. They do confide in us. And then we write what they say. So it's
right.
It's a weird kind of dynamic.
It's a weird dynamic. Yeah. And I think I was so, I mean, that was probably year two of my career. Two and a half of my career. And like luckily that was kind of the first time I felt that, but I know it's part of this longer arc of whatever identity you are as a reporter, when you're like talking to sources of the same identity, there can be that assumption. And there's moments in your career where you have to like lay down the law, like, no, this is actually how journalism works. I'm being respectful of you because I'm hearing you and I'm writing it. That's how this flows.
Let me ask you a final question. You've come up in a different land than I came up in. When I came up, first newspaper job, I was going into a newsroom every day. I literally, at the National Tennessean, would see them printing the papers. I would go down and grab a warm one off the press. It was great, right? I assume I'm talking to you from your apartment. I'm assuming you don't go into the New York Times office particularly often.
3 days a week.
Do you go in 3 days a week?
Yeah.
Okay, wait, great. Does the newsroom still give you something on those 3 days a week? Like, do you actually like going in? Is there a buzz to a newsroom, or is it a different landscape than yesteryear?
If you were asking me this question like a month ago, I would say like, oh, the charm is gone. But now people are coming in more and you're having those one-off conversations. Like it even happened yesterday. I put in a photo request for something and an editor walked over. It's like, oh, the thing you should know about the context for the story you're writing, da-da-da. And like he wouldn't have done that as Slack. So I appreciate that. And especially I've only been at the Times for a year. So I'm still trying to catch a vibe. And so it's actually really helpful that more people are coming in, that you're having just like a mass of people. But when I think back to when I first started in 2016 professionally, it's different. It feels different.
Different bad or different good?
I mean, I would like more people in the office just because of the benefit of just like, okay, we're all here. I commute at 40 minutes. I'm glad we're all here together. But there are positives from hybrid work, like when I need to actually write and just think and not like have people come up. It's nice to have that benefit of being able to stay home. But what I would like to get back to is like knowing you're going into the office and like, oh yeah, I'm going to have like one-off conversations or like just the serendipity of things. I love that.
Do you have to go in? Do they say it's a 3-day week in the office job or do you want to go in?
Like, yes, but also it's not, these are the 3 days we're in, so it can be scattershot, but I make sure I go in 3-4 times a week sometimes, to have those moments of like, seeing people and bouncing ideas off of people.
Awkward final question. What are you going to do when you and I open up our Bessemer based Waffle House? Like, how are you going to work?
It's going to be in Bessemer for sure.
Yeah, but how are you going to get it? How are you going to go to the office 3 times a week and hold the New York Times job while we're running a Waffle House?
What if we make the Waffle House the Bessemer Bureau of the New York Times?
I see where you're going.
Yep.
That way we can cover the excitement of Bessemer at the scene, serving the community 24 hours of awesome waffles.
Yes. And we'll have the print paper for them.
Or we could, you know, we could take this different and we can actually start the Waffle House Times. You can leave the Times, I'll stop writing books, and we will start our own Waffle House themed newspaper.
I think you should just write a book about the Waffle House in Bessemer.
I just want to say, I took my kid on a college tour and he'd never been to a Waffle House because he was a spoiled California kid. And we were in the South and I was like, we're going to Waffle House. And we ate at Waffle House and he was like, this is good. And I was like, duh, it's a Waffle House.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then if he goes to college in the South, he can eat there at 3 a.m.
And then when he comes home weighing 75,000 pounds, I'll be like, Waffle House.
Exactly. I love it.
Jordan, thank you so much for doing this. Very much appreciated. Big admirer. Love your career. Love your career trajectory. Think you do great work. And I'm a fan. And I don't want to get you too excited, but I'm now following you on Instagram.
Oh, I'm excited. This was so fun. Thank you for this.
My pleasure. I want to thank today's guest, Jordan Holman, for joining me on Two Writers Sing and Yang. You can follow Jordan on Twitter at Jordan, and that's Jordan with a Y, Journals, so Jordan Journals, and read her work in the New York Times. If you have a chance and you enjoy Two Writers Sing and Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the fantastic MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me, and remember, keep writing.